Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture.
A central concept for Albert Camus, particularly in his early works like The Myth of Sisyphus and in its what you might call its companion piece, The Stranger, is this notion of the absurd. And sometimes people say Albert Camus was not strictly speaking an existentialist, he was an absurdist. Not actually correct to say that because he is in a broad sense, but the absurd is really central to Camus' conception of reality, of human being, and his own form of existentialist philosophy. So what we want to do is look at what he actually means by the absurd. And we don't want to get bogged down in a lot of individual examples. What we want to do is look at the broadest, most overarching, systematic, structural understanding of absurdity. And I realize that there's a little bit of irony there, or absurdity, or however you want to put it, in this notion that we can have a general idea of absurdity. But it's there in Camus' work. So if you want to really understand what he means by, say, the absurd person, or the absurd world, or absurdity in general, you really want to get this concept down. And you notice I've got this sort of triadic structure here. We're going to explore that in just a few minutes. We're asking ourselves, what exactly is the absurd? Before we explore that, before we look at some of the passages that I think are particularly important in a sort of systematic, connected portion of the Myth of Sisyphus, I want to bring up two other passages that occur a little bit later in the Myth of Sisyphus, because they illustrate two important sides of absurdity and of Camus' philosophy in general. So, he calls the absurd lucid reason noting its limits. What does that mean? That means that when rationality, which is, remember, what is distinctive to a human being, when reason actually explores the world that it knows, turns inward on itself, looks at its own capacities, it becomes aware of the irrational, not as something that can be washed away or done away with as a problem, but as something that is going to plague it, something that is in a certain sense unfixable. The other passage, he says that the absurd, once we become aware of it, it is a passion the most harrowing of all. Now, I like these two passages because what you've got here is a really almost exclusive emphasis on the intellectual or the rational, the cognitive aspects of human being here. And then on the other hand, we're talking about a passion. So what are we meaning there? The emotional, the desirous, the affective, the appetitive side of human existence. And these are both the absurd. The feeling of the absurd and the experience of the absurd are both integral to it. They're not neatly separable from each other. And as a matter of fact, that's the way it is for human being. The affective side of human being is not something that you can neatly strip away from the intellectual side. Even, you might say, concepts themselves have their affective side to them. Concepts are things that we want to think about, we want to think about, we desire. They come with certain moods. This is fairly typical stuff that you find in existentialist philosophy. This is a theme that you see over and over and over again, whether you're looking at Camus, whether you're looking at Sartre, whether you're looking at Heidegger, whether you're looking at Kierkegaard, Nietzsche. The notion that affectivity and rationality, or the work of the intellect, the mind and the heart, are actually interfused with each other. So, that said, let's come back to this over here. Why do I have this three-part, this triadic relationship? Well, because Camus himself says that that's something that we have to get in order to grasp what the absurd actually is. There is a tendency to want to locate the absurd in persons, the subject, or to want to locate it in the world, in objects, in the self, in the other, trying to put it over here or over there. Those don't actually work according to Camus. So the question that we want to think about is, well, why not? And The answer is contained in a discussion that he engages in, where he actually sort of reverses course at a certain point. He says, I said that the world is absurd. So that's locating it on this side, right? And, you know, when you read Camus' The Stranger, or you read parts of the Myth of Sisyphus, you might say, ah, we're stuck in this absurd world that just doesn't make sense. Camus says, no, the world itself is not absurd. He says, I was too hasty in saying that. This world in itself is not reasonable. It's not rational through and through. It resists what we want it to be, to become, and to conform to. So he says, what is absurd is the confrontation of this irrational, the world, and this wild longing for clarity whose call echoes in the human heart. We're going to get to that in a moment. But that's the person, that's the self, that's the subject, the human being. The absurd is a confrontation between self and world. Why is it a confrontation? Because the self desires, like he says, the self desires something out of the world, and the world disappoints. He's not talking here merely about not getting what you wanted out of life in the sense that, well, I want to marry somebody who has these particular qualities, or I want this kind of job, or once I get the job, I want this promotion, or I want to go to this school, or even, you know, something as trivial as, I would like to try this kind of candy over here, and, you know, that you just don't get to do it. Those are disappointments. Those are not what we might call disappointments on a fundamental moral or ontological level. That ties in with the absurd. So what does he have in mind? He says, you know, there's wild longing for clarity. We're going to explore that in a moment. He says, the absurd depends as much on man as on the world. For the moment, it is all that links them together. That's a really important point. What's going on here is you don't have a self. This is very, you know, sort of typical late modern philosophy. You don't have a self as an individual existing all by itself outside of a world. The self explores what it is, finds out what it is, learns about its capacities by engaging with things outside of it, outside of itself. You know, whether this be objects in the environment or whether these be other selves, other human beings who it is connected with. On the other hand, and this is something that modern philosophy has been very good about revealing, you don't have a world existing as world, as something that can be perceived, something that's meaningful, without having subjectivity that is engaged with the world. So you might say, from a Camusian perspective, were human beings not to be there, you would have things. You might say you even have a universe, but you wouldn't have a world. You wouldn't have something that can confront a human being, something that is organized to some degree, that has meaning to some degree. It's the fact that it has meaning to some degree that allows it to even be absurd in the first place. So, the absurd depends just as much on man as on the world, and he says, for the moment, it is all that links them together. It binds them one to the other as only hatred can weld two creatures together. This is all I can discern clearly in this measureless universe where my adventure takes place. So, if we want to say where is the absurd, it's not just in the self. It's not just some sort of morbid personality quirk that somebody might have where they just don't find meaning in things even though other people do. Nor is it out there in the world so that everybody ought to be able to get it. You know, it's something that's completely clear to anyone who just looks at the world. It's in the engagement between the self and the world, which means that it's going to be individuated, which means also that to a certain degree, you can outline general features of the absurd, but you can't completely wrap your head around what it means for the absurd to be outside of the perspective of individual human beings for whom there is absurdity in the relationship between self and world. So now we want to actually look at this. And Camus spells out a few different ways in which this happens. And again, remember the relationship between intellect and affectivity when we're doing this. He says, as soon as the human being begins to really think, begins to think things through, what they're going to see is that things don't completely add up. They don't completely make sense. And when we think in part reflexively inside of ourself, right? We make ourselves into objects of thought. But much of it is an engagement between us and the world. We're trying to think the world. We're trying to make sense out of the other people that we have to deal with, the history that we're involved in, the systems, the environment, the physical objects that we have to endure, engage, explore. So he says, the mind's deepest desire, what it is that our intellects really want the most, even in its most elaborate operations, parallels man's unconscious feeling in the face of this universe. What is the relationship that the subject has to the environing objects? He says that it's an insistence on familiarity, an appetite for clarity. Understanding the world for a man is reducing it to the human, stamping it with his seal. The truism, all thought is anthropomorphic, has no other meaning. We want the world to be a familiar place, comfortable, reliable, someplace that actually makes sense to us. And he says, if man realized that the universe, like him, can love and suffer, if the universe were really like us, he would be reconciled. If thought discovered in the shimmering mirrors of phenomena, eternal relations capable of summing them up and summing themselves up in a single principle, then would be seen an intellectual joy of which the myth of the blessed would be a ridiculous imitation. We want order. We want things to make sense. He calls this a nostalgia for unity, the appetite for the absolute. And he says this illustrates the essential impulse of the human drama. We want things to make sense. We want them to be rational. We want there to be meaning that we can rely on. Not just meaning up here at the superficial level, meaning running all the way down to the very roots of being. The problem is, that's not what the world is going to provide you. That's not what you get in this environment. That's not what you'll ever get, he thinks. We've always got this nostalgia for something that we feel is lost or missing, but it was never there to begin with. We never had that, and we're always seeking that, and we want that from the world. And the world can only give that to us if, in fact, the world is rational. But unfortunately, the world, although it is rational in parts, locally, is not globally rational. You might say, well, yeah, but everything's subject to natural laws. Remember, this is a humanized universe. It's not just the fact that, say, gravity exists everywhere. We want things to make sense to human beings, and not just the stunted sort of human being that thinks of everything in terms of, say, mathematics or natural science, but the human being that can actually feel, think, desire, understand the entire universe in terms of human qualities. Well, the universe doesn't give that. It gives it in parts. But those are always localized, those are always vulnerable, those are always subject. As soon as we start thinking, as soon as we start exercising thought upon it, those end up getting corroded away. It's fragmented, he says. He has a beautiful passage. With its first move, this world cracks and tumbles. An infinite number of shimmering fragments is offered to the understanding. We must despair of ever reconstructing the familiar calm surface which would give us peace of heart, which would satisfy our desires. After so many centuries of inquiries, so many abdications among thinkers, we are well aware that this is true for all of our knowledge. Only rationalists, people who have a sort of blind faith in science or logic or rationality, really think, according to Camus, that we can find in the world this thing that would actually conform to our deep desires. It says, of whom and of what indeed can I say, I know that? I understand this through and through. This heart within me, I can feel and I judge that it exists. This world I can touch and I likewise judge that it can exist, that it exists. There ends all my knowledge. All the rest is construction. All the rest is what I project out onto the world. And that's not reliable. That could be up for doubt. As a matter of fact, he's not just a Cartesian saying, well, you know, I could doubt this. He's actually saying, well, when you actually put it to the test, usually it falls apart. Our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of the world, our understanding of others that we take as reliable knowledge, oftentimes it turns out not to be so. the things that turn out to be reliable turn out to be meaningless, is another problem. So he says, between the certainty I have of my existence and the content I try to give to that assurance, the gap will never be filled. I will always be a stranger to myself. All the knowledge on earth will give me nothing to assure me that this world is mine. You describe it to me and you teach me to classify it. You enumerate its laws, and in my thirst for knowledge, I admit that they're true. You take apart its mechanism and my hope increases. At the final stage, you teach me that this wondrous and multicolored universe can be reduced to the atom, and this atom can be reduced to the electron. All this is good. I wait for you to continue. Seems like we're actually getting to the rationality that we want. But then you tell me of an invisible planetary system in which electrons gravitate around a nucleus. You explain this to me with an image. I realize you have been reduced to poetry. Poetry is not what science pretended to be. Something reliable, something that will give me the assurance that my nostalgia is driving me towards. So the world is absurd insofar as it participates in the absurdity that's taking place in this contradiction between what the self, the human subject, desires to find out there in the world. That's why there can be absurdity in the world. So he says, to will, to desire, to want anything is to stir up paradoxes. So this applies just as much to our heart, our affective side, as it applies to our mind, our intellectual side. It all ends up turning out to be absurd, according to Camus. Everything is ordered in such a way, he says, as to bring into being that poisoned peace produced by thoughtlessness, lack of heart, or fatal renunciations. So the intelligence tells me in its way that this world is absurd. It's contrary, blind reason, sort of a ideological, I'm going to hide my head in the sand and just pretend everything's okay, hiding from oneself, hiding from the world, you know, fooling oneself, says that everything is clear, but that's not going to work for us. Once we become aware, attuned to this gap, this irreconcilable separation that we can't actually get away from because we're not truly separate, this infinite desire that we have on our part, which can never be satisfied by the things that we turn to, we must recognize, Camus thinks, absurdity. But the absurdity, this is what I want to really stress, and this is what I want to end with, the absurdity does not lie here or here alone. It lies in all three of these, and most particularly in this confrontation between the two sides. Only that really gives us the absurd.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.